see it.
Interim meeting, informal hearing of the Regulated Industries Committee to order. Many of you have looked over the agenda, and first of all, just a couple instructions. Mr. Keegan is our first and primary witness here to discuss telecom policies in other states, and in what he has saw as someone who follows these regulations and changes in all the states in the nation. But other testifiers, as we have them come forward, I just need to remind everybody to sign in on the witness sheet today. Members, we need to keep our materials together as we're going to continue after lunch with a joint hearing with the Ag and Rural Development Committee on renewable energy standards. And so we want to keep everything, but we are meeting in this room after lunch, and so everything can stay here. Welcome back to the committee. How I envision these 2 hours or 2.5 hours to go, Mr. Keegan has got a fairly in-depth presentation for us, and we want to leave some time for questions. And if time allows, we'd like to have different groups that have comments, whether it's consumer protection groups or other telecom or cable groups or concerns, that could at least respond or talk about some issues that they also would like to see changed in the state or not changed in the state. And so if time allows, but Mr. Keegan is here from, I believe, California?
Washington.
Washington. And Mr. Keegan, why don't you introduce yourself and your background, and welcome to our committee, and we're looking forward to your input.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm from the American Legislative Exchange Council in Washington, D.C. Specifically, I'm the director of the Telecommunications and Information Technology Task Force for ALEC. For those of you who aren't familiar with ALEC, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan association with a membership of roughly 2,500 state legislators from across the country that share a common belief in Jeffersonian principles of limited government, free markets, federalism, and individual liberty. As the chairman said, I provided written remarks. I'll deviate from them somewhat. And if time allows, I understand that there are some other speakers. I certainly don't want to monopolize all the time here today. But there are some additional comments that were not in the testimony that I will provide just to expand on some points. So I'll just go ahead and get started with the written portion of my remarks today. There's a well-known Chinese proverb that says, "May you live in interesting times." And for policymakers, consumers, and companies that offer telecommunications services, these are indeed interesting times. We need only review a Best Buy or Circuit City circular on Sunday paper to realize just the rapid change, technological advances, and the array of products and services are now available on the market. Services unmanageable just 10 or 15 years ago are now being provided today as voice, video, and data services are converging in a way that people couldn't have predicted a generation ago. With all the incredible advancements of the last 20 years, there is substantial evidence to suggest that our telecommunications and technology industries are being sufficiently or artificially constrained by a patchwork of state and local regulations that stymie new advances, provide incentives and disincentives that stunt intermodal competition, that provides consumers with a wide full range of options. Quite simply, the pace of technological development is moving faster than the ability of policymakers to keep up. This has led to the central question that this committee is trying to address. How should these products and services be regulated? And how will changes to the state's existing telecommunications law affect consumers and the providers of these amazing products and services? I hope to answer this question today. To better understand the current environment and to help chart a future course, it might be helpful to look back at the previous attempts to regulate telecommunications and measure their effectiveness. Like many other industries, telecommunications has been duly regulated by state and federal governments for the better part of six decades. These regulations were put in place to protect consumers from unscrupulous companies or to establish a competitive playing field that could not be established by market forces. This is kind of the natural monopoly that economists talk about. In 1934, almost 58 years after Alexander Graham Bell was credited with discovering telephony in 1876, and almost 50 years after the Bell Telephone Company merged with AT&T, Congress passed and President Roosevelt signed into law the first major federal regulations of the nascent communications industry. The law is perhaps best known for creating the Federal Communications Commission, but it also provided new regulatory power for the states. 50 years after the Communications Act of 1934, the telecommunications industry was fundamentally changed again, this time the result of an antitrust suit that resulted in AT&T's divestiture in 1984. The divestiture allowed AT&T to retain its long-distance network, but seven regional Bell operating companies, or RBOCs, were separated from the parent company and allowed to remain as regulated monopolies, providing only local telephone service. The mergers and consolidation, the seven original RBOCs created by the 1984 divestiture, Ameritech, Bell Atlantic, Bell South, 9X, Pacific Bell, Southwestern Bell, and U.S. West, have subsequently been reduced to four: Bell South, Quest, SBC, and Verizon. Because AT&T had such a monopoly in local and long-distance services, not to mention equipment and new technologies through its ownership of Western Electric and Bell Laboratories, the effects of the divestiture were profound. Prior to the divestiture, AT&T had approximately 90% share of local access lines and more than 90% of long-distance revenue. In the preceding years, competition in the long-distance market caused AT&T's market share to drop 45%, and revenue fell as increased competition lowered prices dramatically. Ironically, AT&T today is poised to be acquired by one of the RBOCs that were spun off by the divestiture, SBC. In part because the AT&T divestiture showed that competition could work in the long-distance market, and because the telecommunications industry had evolved since the 1934 Act, Congress overhauled federal telecom laws again with the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. As the divestiture had opened the long-distance market, the 96 Act sought to establish competition in the local market. 9 years after its enactment, economists, academics, policymakers, and the affected stakeholders, namely companies and consumers, are still debating its impact on telecommunications. Many provisions are still being litigated, and there appears to be a growing dissatisfaction with the Act on both sides of the political spectrum. This has led to a chorus calling for repeal of the Act, or at least a comprehensive rewrite to reflect the current market realities. There have been widespread rumors that Congress would take up legislation this year, but the odds of broad reform this year are remote, given other priorities in the last month. Given the intensity of the interest, though, sweeping congressional action is likely within the next several years. The 1996 Act has become a bit of a political pinata, with policy and academics from both ends of the spectrum lining up to take their shots. There are several different lines of attack, some lamenting the interest group politics that purportedly rewarded long-established firms, while others have criticized its lack of deregulation. There are some that have said that it wasn't really deregulation at all, it was merely changing boxes and a flowchart, that it didn't allow the market to really open up. The major substantive criticism of the 96 Act and the clarion call for proponents of a major overhaul, if not repeal, is that it did not settle the question of how to regulate in a new era and for a market that was changing at breakneck speed. Communications law had always been premised on a given transmission platform, such as a cable or telephone network, being used to provide specific service independent of other platforms. In this world, services were pigeonholed according to distinctions such as telephone, wireless, or cable, as if there wouldn't be any crossover. As was discussed earlier, this will no longer exist because convergence of voice, video, and data services have obliterated these artificial distinctions and pitted these formerly distinct sectors against each other in the marketplace. Another criticism of the 96 Act concerns the unbundling requirements designed to stimulate competition in the local telephone market. Congress directed regulators to devise network sharing rules that would enable new entrants to offer local phone service without building their own networks. The FCC established unbundling rules that required incumbent local exchange carriers, ILECs, for the most part, the regional Bell operating companies, to sell access to all parts of their network to competitors at below-cost prices. These unbundling provisions also allowed entrants to lease those parts of the network that they needed. Well, unbundling may have originally been intended only as a temporary effort to allow startups to enter a formally closed market without having to build networks from scratch. As new entrants, they may not have had the access to capital necessary to build these networks. That was the rationale for the leasing requirements. The unbundling rules have been embroiled in a series of regulatory and legal challenges for years. This uncertainty, in conjunction with the tightening of credit markets after the telecom bubble burst in 2000, has been charged with exacerbating the decline in network investments as the generous terms extended to resellers created a disincentive to build. It is much cheaper for a new entrant to rent access to existing networks at prices set by regulators than to build their own facilities. From the perspective of an ILEC, it makes little sense to upgrade equipment when it would be forced to lease the upgraded network at low rates to its competitors. While there's been much good news in the telecommunications industry in terms of new products being brought to market at increasingly lower prices, the contraction of investment, in part because of the regulatory uncertainty, has contributed to sobering statistics. In the 4 years between March 2000 and July 2004, investment in the telecommunications service industry dropped by roughly 67%, from $1.14 trillion to $375 billion. As might be expected, job losses were also dramatic. From March 2001 to May 2004, the telecommunications industry lost approximately 380,000 jobs. Of the number of U.S. jobs lost during the same period, 29% were in the telecommunications industry. Unbundling and lack of regulatory clarity alone cannot be blamed for this contraction, as industry consolidation, the inevitable speculative bubble burst as internet growth rates leveled off, and financial scandals at companies such as WorldCom and Global Crossing also played a role. The data suggests, though, that the 96 Telecommunications Act's approach to competition has not worked as advertised and is woefully inadequate in the present reality of converged services and different platforms. And to expand on a point that's not in the written testimony, there's certainly differing schools of thought about deregulation, about competition. It certainly isn't easy to get it right. It's easy for everyone to criticize regulators and lawmakers, but the simple reality is it's not easy to get these things right. Economic studies have demonstrated that the speed and scope of deregulation is as important as deregulation itself. Based on the experiences of other industries that have been deregulated, such as airlines, trucking, wireless telephones, when strong competition existed, the benefits when strong competition existed. The slow and incremental approach to deregulation not only delayed the benefits consumers reap from competition, but also created economic distortions and dislocations. The delayed piecemeal deregulation led to economic losses. By contrast, quick and complete economic deregulation, the deregulation of prices and market restrictions, in an industry such as wireless phones, yielded immediate benefits to consumers and caused less severe transitional problems. While comparing wireless and wireline policy is akin to comparing apples to oranges, the wireless experience suggests a potential regulatory regime. Like other industries that were deregulated in the 70s and 80s, the telecom industry has experienced technical innovations and market disruptions, new entrants, evolving technology, that might make it ripe for new regulatory treatment. New entrants generally focus their efforts.
Mr. Keegan?
I'm sorry.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to let members know. I think we've got enough time, so if there are things, as Mr. Keegan's going over them, you have questions on or want to explore a little deeper, feel free to ask questions, if that's all right, Mr. Keegan, during your testimony. Otherwise, sometimes you get to the end and you forget what you were going to ask on something.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, that's fine, and okay. Certainly, if there's a time constraint, I'll certainly not deviate from the written remarks.
No, I think we've got time. We want to utilize your experience and insight as much as we can. So I just want members to feel free to ask questions if you do have on issues that we'll ask at the end as well, but we can ask now, too. So.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. The 96 Act was a partial deregulation that repealed the RBOC's their monopoly over local services, but retained most other aspects of regulation. Instead of competing on the merits of their technology business plans, incumbents and competitors must try to game the regulatory process for a competitive advantage. Wireless has been a different story. In 1993, Congress directed the FCC to auction off the Personal Communications Service, PCS, that's what you'll hear sometimes in reference, particularly to Sprint technology, uses the personal communication service, the spectrum for wireless telephony. The auctions began in 1994, and the first PCS system started in 1995. At the same time, the limitation of two wireless carriers per market was lifted. By 2003, 97% of U.S. consumers had three or more wireless service providers to choose from, and 80% had access to five or more competitors, according to FCC data. Post-regulation of cellular service was also lifted in 1995, and as mentioned earlier, the number of wireless consumers increased dramatically, so that there were 181 million cellular subscribers by 2003. It's estimated that 6% of Americans have completely cut the cord and use their wireless phones exclusively.
What percent? Six?
6%. 6%.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Keegan. Trying to follow along with your remarks here in the written testimony. What page are you on?
This was not in the written testimony.
I missed that. I was thinking along another.
I apologize. I will provide this as well. There were things I jotted down on the trip out here that I realized that the testimony itself may not be adequate to fill the time allotted. So I will provide all these in written.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keegan, the data you're providing us right now be hugely helpful as we wrestle with some of these things.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Mr. Keegan, on that wireless issue, you said 1995 it was deregulated. Prior to that, what was the regulation structure on wireless as it was developing?
At the federal level, I believe it was just rate regulation, much like you'd have in telephone regulation.
Okay.
I'd have to find the specific site for you.
Sure. Okay. And maybe some of the wireless providers in the cloud might have more insight on that.
Yeah. Okay. Apologies for that.
No, I've thought that perhaps it was unregulated from its infancy, and from your testimony, it actually had regulations removed or barred in 1995?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. 6% of Americans have completely cut the cord on their wireless, on their wireline phones and use wireless exclusively. This is also borne out by the fact that consumers used more than 600 billion minutes in 2002, up more than 5% from 2001. Again, I'll provide this information for you and the citations on the statistics for you. Meanwhile, wireline usage declined by roughly 60 billion minutes between 2001 and 2002. The competition among wireless carriers more than just lowered prices and increased the migration from wireline to wireless services. It also provided new marketing strategies that eliminated roaming charges, provided free long distance, also new services such as friends and family plans. These are new marketing developments that were borne out by the competition amongst wireless competitors. Deregulation always comes with some risk, but anecdotal evidence suggests that a complete elimination of rate regulation is preferable to a piecemeal incremental approach if robust competition already exists. Most people would stipulate that that is the case in the current environment. Which brings us back to the state of competition. I'll return to my formal written comments. People want to follow along.
So Mr. Keegan, I'm going to go back to something earlier. You said that there was eight RBOC and we're down to four that broke up after 1984.
Yes.
How is that working? If competition broke them up and half of them are not in existence anymore, how would you see this playing out, or how would you say that is fulfilling the competitive market?
Sure. Incumbent local exchange carriers, ILEX, are basically the RBOC, and there are four, and they have their service territories, and they serve states. Within states, there are competitive local exchange competitors, better known as CLEX. CLEX compete with ILEX at the state and local level. So their competition in the local market comes from CLEX, and CLEX can be cable companies that also provide telephone service, and just any startup local phone company that provides service. So ILEX, ILEX do not compete against each other at a national level. They compete with CLEX and other competitors within the states.
Okay.
I'm going to, if you don't mind, there's actually some information on CLEX in the written
sure.
comment that may clarify some of this.
Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir. Despite the aforementioned regulatory challenges, the telecommunications industry is remarkably competitive. The critics are quick to point out that much of the competition has occurred in the minimally regulated areas of long distance and wireless services. According to the FCC's most recent analysis of local telephone competition, at least one competitive local exchange carrier, CLEX, was serving 78% of the nation's zip code at the end of 2004. Roughly 97% of U.S. households reside in these zip codes, and the FCC reports that multiple carriers reported providing local telephone service in the major population centers of the country. The FCC report also suggests that wireless service continues to offer a real alternative as consumers utilize roughly 145 million incumbent local exchange carrier switch access lines, 32.9 million CLEC switch access lines, and 181 million wireless telephone subscriptions. Nationwide, mobile wireless telephone subscribers increased 8% during the second half of 2004, and for the year, the number of wireless subscribers increased by 15%. Nationally, CLEX provides service to 15% of residential and small businesses and 29% of medium and small business. Economists have suggested that the unbundling provisions as described above that do not provide incentives to build new networks has stunted local competition. In Minnesota, there are 19 CLEX, and 61% of residential and small business consumers can receive service from CLEX if they choose. CLEX account for 21% of end-user switched access lines. This is up from 6% in 1999. 29% of these access lines are CLEC owned, while the others are either leased or resold lines. Reflecting the national trend, the number of wireless telephone subscribers increased 11% in 2004 to almost 3 million. Roughly 60% of Minnesotans subscribe to wireless telephone services, and they benefit from a robust competitive environment, as the FCC reports that 10 carriers provide services in the state.
So, Mr. Keegan, how does that compare with other states? Are we right in the middle, or several states providing more CLEC competition, or less?
Actually, Minnesota is very strong. Has a very strong CLEC penetration rate. I've been told this, but I don't actually have the statistic that roughly 50% of call traffic is handled by CLEX. Again, I can't vouch for that. I've just heard it. But certainly, in terms of the number of CLEX, that's a very good record.
Okay.
This is a good start. Local competition still lags behind other sectors. Wireless telephone services, relatively new technology even today, were allowed to proliferate without the same level of regulatory constraints as landline telephones, as I mentioned earlier. According to the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association, there were roughly 2 million cell phone subscribers in 1986. Today, there are more than 180 million. When the 96 Act was signed, there were approximately 38 million wireless telephone subscribers. The subsequent innovations and competition increased cell phone subscribers by more than 400%. Prices have fallen as well. According to FCC data, the permanent price for cell phone calls have dropped 75% in 10 years, from 44 cents per minute to less than 11 cents per minute in 2002. That's the last year of that the FCC had data. That number is surely even lower now. As a result, the average monthly cell phone usage in 2002 was 427 minutes, up 200% from the 140-minute average in 1993. Markets can work and provide better services at lower prices when allowed to. Telecommunications services, like I said before, are duly regulated by the federal and state governments. While much of the focus of my testimony is focused on federal efforts to regulate, or deregulate for that matter, the industry states do play an important role. Of particular importance to providers and consumers is the state's ability to regulate rates and prices. Recognizing the rapid pace of technological innovations and product development, states have stepped in to fill the vacuum left by the federal government's inability to establish a more competitive marketplace. In 2005 alone, 15 states considered legislation to roll back their decades-old regulations to allow a more competitive environment. six states, Alabama, Idaho, Iowa, Oregon, Tennessee, and Utah, actually passed legislation to ease regulations. While these bills differ in some regards, they all kept the existing state regulatory entity in place to field consumer complaints and adjudicate disputes between consumers and local phone companies. On these legislative initiatives, however, the state will no longer set rates or dictate the way that companies bundle their services. It is fairly safe to assume that additional states will consider similar deregulation measures in 2006. No state is an island, well, Hawaii, I guess, being the sole exception to that. So those states that ease decades-old regulations have a competitive advantage over those that do not. States that provide regulatory clarity and increased competition will be able to lure employers, while others that regulate for a world that no longer exists will be at a real disadvantage. Opponents of deregulation have argued that the current regulatory regime protects consumers, but as more states get out of the rate regulation business, consumers could actually be harmed as jobs and investments flow to states with better competitive environments. Just conclude, while much of the existing federal and state regulation has proven inadequate in this age of convergence of voice, video, and data services, which is one reason why the United States ranks 16th globally in broadband deployment, the current regulatory regime is equally unprepared for emerging technologies and services such as voice over internet protocol and so-called mega broadband that researchers are developing that will provide broadband services to homes and businesses at speeds of 100 megabits per second. This is 10 times faster than current broadband speeds available to most Americans. Researchers have said that the challenge of delivering this ultra-high broadband to the public is far less about technology and more about politics and government policy. Alec believes that full and open competition, not multiple layers of regulation, should drive healthy and sustainable competitive markets, and such has supported balanced telecommunications regulations that more accurately reflect today's competitive marketplace. America's telecommunications and information technology industries have succeeded in spite of our current regulatory approach, not because of it, and most state and federal policymakers recognize that the time has come to modernize our laws to remain competitive with countries such in Europe and Asia. This is a brave new world, and I encourage you to embrace it for the sake of your constituents and the companies and the business in your state. This concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have. Having said that, I understand it. Maybe you all wanted me to speak a little bit longer. So if there's any other areas, by all means, I'd be happy to expand.
Mr. Keegan, have you looked at what some of the other states that you mentioned have done with their deregulation plans? I mean, how extensive have they gone, or is it just removing one or two regulations and then they call it changed?
For the most part,
what have they done? Do you know?
Yeah, sure. For the most part, they've removed the obligation to seek rate approval. Gotten the PUC or whatever the regulating entity is in the state out of the business of setting prices and let the market determine that. What states have done in that area is that they may establish bans, 5-year bans where there's no rate regulation, and then in 5 years there would be a review just to make sure that prices were still in line and consumers were still benefiting from it. But by and large, what they've done is they've retained the existing regime, regulatory regime, in terms of responding to fraud, consumer complaints, and also acting as a kind of referee. But those states that have actually deregulated in the past couple of years have primarily just deregulated on the rate front.
Okay. So our follow-up here, and then Representative Thiessen, how all of them were fairly recent, so we don't have any 2 or 3 year data or outcome that's been at least tried or ascertained from what they changed.
Yes, sir. That's right. I'm fairly confident that other states had deregulated even before 2005. I don't have that right now, but it is one of those things that when we look at deregulation and reduction in price and benefits to consumers, in a lot of ways we are looking at anecdotal evidence of other industries, and while there may be certain comparisons that can be drawn, it's certainly not perfect comparisons. I mean, every industry is different. Certainly, all products are different. We look at other areas, and we have reason to believe that it would work. But you're right. I mean, certainly, those states that have enacted deregulation last year or two, there's no real data to suggest that the price would come down. But I think everybody assumes that they would.
Sure. Representative Thiessen.
You asked my question.
Oh. Questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Keegan, for coming.
Thank you.
In how many states is there litigation going on in regard to one of our provisions that we passed in 2004, which requires a provider to let the consumer know the terms of the contract, et cetera? In other words, both companies sort of have an equal say, I think, before a consumer can switch. Are there many lawsuits going on in that regard?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I know there are going to be some other stakeholders that may be speaking today, and maybe they can answer that. I'm happy to follow up with you. I just don't know that.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Keegan, do you know, in states, is there much regulation going on that prevents maybe an equal competition or protects the consumer? Are you aware of any of that?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, there certainly are. States have taken different approaches. Certainly, that's right. If I may, one of the issues that I had been asked to cover, and it was not in my prepared remarks, dealt with a bill that you all considered last year on video franchising. I think this may be some of kind of what you're asking about. Video franchising, cable companies primarily provide video services, and telephone companies are now looking to enter that market as well. There are locally negotiated franchises. Cable primarily negotiates these with and achieves local franchising authority. That certainly provides it's a very cumbersome process. If you are a telephone company and you want to offer cable service video services, to have to obtain franchising a license basically from the thousands of local franchising entities in the country, that presents a real logistical problem. From cable's standpoint, and even it's not just cable industry, but other local groups, municipalities are also concerned with this kind of franchising. If you take cities out of the franchising mix and allow providers to obtain a single state franchise, they lose some element of control. Certainly, they lose revenue as well. But if there's just percentage paid to the state instead of the localities, it's the same amount of money theoretically. And let me also say, I'm sorry, I know I'm kind of butchering this answer as I go along. This is an issue that ALEC is currently addressing. We are trying to develop a policy internally. So that was why I try to steer clear of that in my written remarks. But there are other, to answer the question, yes, there are obstacles for crossover, and that's something that is being looked at. And certainly, video franchising is one of the issues. It's also a huge issue in Congress. There are three bills pending in Congress right now that would allow phone companies, in particular, to acquire state franchise, a single state franchise, or in some cases a national franchise, so they could provide video services in any state. But again, it's an issue that we are trying to develop internally, and I can't really claim from ALEC's standpoint to have a position on that. But you are right that there certainly are some barriers across different services to entry, and that's just one of them.
So, follow up, Representative Erickson.
No, thank you.
So perhaps as you guys develop your data on that, could you pass it on to our committee?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
We are actively working the issue. issue our legislators are concerned about. It's an issue, obviously, that other stakeholders are very concerned about. It's also an issue that consumer groups and tax advocates and others have gotten involved in. So it's a high-profile issue. We're developing policy, and we'll be happy to follow. I'll be happy to follow up with you.
Sure. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keegan, I know you just said you haven't developed a policy on this area, but it's one that a bill that I'm carrying has runs directly into this whole discussion of just what value do cities and counties bring franchise rights, and some law that makes it possible for them to control those things. Is there any other value that they bring to the marketplace by creating franchises? And as I'm thinking, particularly where there's a fixed plant that's required to deliver the service, like a dial tone or a gas line or something like that, I think there's right-of-way involved.
Yep.
Those kind of utility easements, is that where they fit into the picture, and is that worth spending? Would you consider these things, or if you want to, we're just freewheeling here at the moment, mind you, which is always dangerous in a political setting, but
yes.
We're kind of wrestling with how to make good policy that's best for the future and that sets the stage for improvisation and consumer benefit. We need to think these things through. I think, and that's for all of us as members. We need to think these things through. And as you think about this, I don't know if you got any reaction to it, your process is mature enough to talk about it without getting killed.
I will tread very lightly into this. I will say, in terms of value that cities bring to the equation, you're right. I mean, certainly their concerns are your right-of-way principle.
Money, by the way.
Precisely. there certainly is a financial component to this as well. I believe the standard is about 5%. That's what cable providers pay to provide video services is 5%. Again, if it's a single state, if the state collects the 5% versus the city's collecting the 5%, from a cable standpoint, it's the same 5%. But municipalities certainly don't look at it that way. And I think there are concerns about the right-of-way issues and also some of the obligations that the providers have to provide, which would be public access channels. There's a fear that if you go with a statewide, state-based franchise, that some of those public access channels, would go by the wayside. You know, I'll leave it to the market to determine whether or not that's a good thing. But certainly, I'm assuming some of your proceedings are on public access channels, or those are some of the concerns. Also, not to speak for them, but what I've seen also is it also gets down to build-out requirements, and that seems to be the real sticky wicket in this issue. And with build-out requirements, if you are if you obtain a video franchise, you agree to build out maybe a certain percentage. The build-out requirements are different, but by and large, you have to provide services to everyone that wants it. Now, I grew up in upstate New York, and because we lived about a mile east of town, we weren't able to get cable services because of that issue. It was a population density issue. We had three people that lived on this road. Cable wasn't going to run wires, that actually made sense. But certainly, it's some of the build-out requirements, and I know some of the potential entrants to the video market have indicated that they would, pick and choose customers. That they would say this is kind of the redlining argument, that you just pick off high value customers and that you wouldn't service others. So I think what a lot of this, of course, is it's yelling back and forth. I would look at this, try to provide a balanced view, because again, I don't have policy on this, and we're just kind of making it up as I go along, and I hope I'm not offending anybody else here. Is that there certainly would be some efficiencies in not having to acquire thousands of franchises to provide video services. At the same time, there are other concerns as well, like I mentioned, certainly build-out requirements. Until we resolve that internally, Alec, and I think once states try to get their hands up, And I should say also, I beg your pardon, I forgot to mention this, Texas passed legislation this past summer in a special session. So they become the first state to pass them. So there may be other states that look at it. And again, there is federal legislation that has been introduced and is at least still there, not receiving much attention right now because, again, there are some other things going on in Washington right now. But it's definitely a very contentious issue.
So, Mr. Keegan, on that point, and then Representative Thiessen and Hilty have a question. Did Texas actually address the build-out issue in their bill that you were talking about?
I believe so. I did not actually see the final version of that. It was adopted, I want to say in August, by the time they got around to it.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I'll be happy to. And maybe some of the other.
If you have any information on that, or maybe Brian or Bob on our staff could track that down with you.
Yeah.
And I know Representative Boyd would probably be interested in that as the author of the bill.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Thiessen and Hilty.
Mr. Chair, if there's people who want to. If Bill, if you're following up on this point, you want a different. Okay. Well, I had about some of the statistics you were talking about. Coming back to the CLEX and competition, and you say it. I'm just trying to get an understanding of what the different things mean. It says 97% of U.S. households reside in zip codes with at least one competitive local exchange carrier, and that there was something about 78% in the zip codes, and 97% of U.S. households reside in those zip codes, and then it says in Minnesota 61%. Of residential and small business customers receive service from CLEX if they choose. And I'm just wondering what those numbers mean and if you know who people are that are not subject to that kind of competition, where those folks live, and if there's any information about how the prices and markets operate where there's not competition versus where these, and why they're not, and kind of follow up, why those people don't have competition. Are there characteristics about their places they live that don't provide that?
Sure.
Mr. Keegan.
Yeah. Obviously, the 78% in the nation zip code and the 97%, that's FCC data indicating the availability of at least some competitive company at the local level. Whether or not they utilize the service, it is available to them. In terms of Minnesota, I'd be happy to try to find out some more of that specific information. That was just aggregated data that the FCC had. There may be some people here who, I'm assuming some of the people here, the other stakeholders may have a better sense of that. I had a hard time finding more state-specific information, so I was simply basing it on the FCC data that was available. In terms of why there may not be more, it certainly gets us into the issue of urban or rural consumers. Certainly, that is an issue, rural consumers. Please.
Well, and if I can just follow up. And in those statistics, you're talking just about the kind of wireline carrier.
Yes, sir.
And do we know how wireless and those other types of services, I suppose broadband faces the same thing as the wire-based services, but is wireless providing a different kind of competition there that's not talked about in these statistics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think earlier in the, I forget this specific statistics right now, so I'll just circle back. In terms of the availability of wireless services, I believe it was 97% Americans have three wireless consumer companies to choose from. 80% have five. So again, this is kind of by zip code. It captures a great number of people. So certainly in terms of wireless, I wouldn't with wireless, from what we've seen from the FCC and others, is that it is largely available to consumers. I know that sometimes the issue can be that wireless provides, but there may be trouble actually acquiring signal or something along those lines. I don't know how prevalent that is in Minnesota. I wouldn't want to hasten a guess, but certainly there seems to be availability of wireless services to consumers who want them.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just two more questions. And I'll
go ahead. That's fine.
Thank you. One, if you could just comment generally kind of on this idea of universal service and how that ties in with competition and deregulation in your mind. And also, kind of at the national level, a lot of this is beyond our control at this point. Where do you see kind of this convergence moving at the national level, and is it something maybe Minnesota ought to wait and see what happens at the national level before we try to do too much with what we can control at the state level?
Mr. Keegan.
I think you're right. I think a lot of this is going to be hashed out if there really is going to be a new Telecommunications Act. Originally, it was going to be the Telecommunications Act of 2005. It may very well be the Telecommunications Act of 2006 at this pace. This may be something that is handled federally. The universal service, it's an excellent social goal. It's a terrific social policy to make sure that everyone that has or wants phone service can get it. It certainly can come at a pretty high price tag, which is why there are kind of subsidies between urban customers to help subsidize rural customers, because it can be awfully pricey if you're one person in a 5-acre plot, and it's kind of costly to run lines to your house. Universal service is meant to subsidize that, and so in a competitive marketplace, you're right. I mean, this may be something that's difficult. There may be a need to rethink how we handle universal service, and I've seen others. Again, I don't mean to punt. We don't really have a policy position on this, but I'll say that I've seen some suggestions of removing the subsidization of the Universal Service Fund and to go with either a broad-based tax or to go with maybe a flat rate on all consumers to try to even out the costs. That seems to be a kind of approach that makes some sense, but again, we don't actually have policy on that, but that's all just off of my own observations.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen, another one?
No, that's
okay.
Not. Thanks.
Thanks. Representative Hilton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. King, and what I wanted to bring up has pretty much been addressed by Representative Thiessen, but not exactly, because what I wanted to ask is, given that you are advocating for at least some additional deregulation, my question is going to be, and I guess you've already answered this in a way, what is your vision in terms of the social consequences if deregulation undermines our ability to provide universal service? You know, I don't see how you can be advocating for something and say, well, that's not part of our vision. Certainly that is a major concern, I would hope, of every member of the legislature sitting at this table. I mean, we're concerned about the effects of policy on our constituents and on the people of the state. And, of course, a major concern is that we don't want to get into a situation where, because we open the market up in just a ill-considered way, we end up making it prohibitively expensive or even impossible to provide vital service to many parts of the state and many of our constituents. And it's not just a question of their personal benefit, it's also a question of economic development, of the whole gamut of social and economic considerations. I'm just interested in your response to that.
Mr. Keegan.
Thank you. you, sir. I would say, and this is not at all to be flippant, when, as I said earlier, when we talk about regulators and legislators and making policy, it isn't easy. I understand that it's not easy and that deregulation comes with risks and regulation comes with certain risks. To govern is to choose, and there can be consequences to public policy. To say that, you know, we don't necessarily have a position on this issue, again, we're just looking at this from a policy standpoint. It's you all that have to make the tough decisions, and I for one respect that, and I know it's not easy. So in terms of us or me having a vision, we're analysts. We look at issues and we look at strengths and weaknesses, and you know, we try to provide some recommendations. But you're right. I mean, these are not easy issues, and so as I try to make the point earlier, you know, that this isn't easy. Deregulation does come with certain risks. But I would say I think there can be. If you look at an industry like, say, airlines, you can have price deregulation and still have safety regulations and safety requirements. So as prices come down, there still is safety requirements that go in this. They're conceivably, as other states have looked at it, they're getting out of the rate regulation business. They're not getting out of the universal service business. And what they're saying, what our states have said, is that the market, most segments of the market are sufficiently competitive that rate regulation potentially stymies innovations and other developments. But at least from what I've seen, states haven't gotten out of the business. Now, certainly there could be some funding challenges, and as I mentioned, there have been suggestions that that there be another funding base, that you look at either a wider tax base, either general revenues or a flat rate fee to kind of spread out the costs. But I think in terms of a vision, there is a fairly competitive market out there, and there are new services that are coming into the mix. And you know, regulation and deregulation both come with costs. And you know, as other states have gone into this, they've determined that there's not a need for rate regulation because there's competition in the marketplace that kind of obviates the need for that kind of regulation. So I hope I've answered your question. I don't know if there was any. I don't know if there's anything else.
Mr. Keegan, just to follow up to that, and then Representative Boot has a question. How does ALEP go about formulating what the policies are, and another organizations that's out there that's at least similar to your organization is the NCSL, that we're all familiar with as well. What, when you're compiling what other states have done or what is going on, how do you come about different policy papers or different suggestions on what should be done, and how do you formulate that?
Sure. We have, within ALEC, we have our task forces, of which I'm the director of the Telecom and Information Technology Task Force, in addition to the Tax and Fiscal Policy Task Force in my spare time. It is through the task forces that we develop policy. ALEC, as I said, is comprised of 2,500 state legislators. There are two legislators that can be appointed to each task force. We also have private sector members as well that also participate in these meetings. And so we develop policy through our task force. And certainly the same applies in terms of other publications that we have principles. We have our principles, and that's what we use to guide our policy, the development of our policy, and certainly the enunciation of our policy through various publications. So, and also to answer your question, we have three national meetings each year, bring together public and private sector members, and we discuss issues such as this.
So do they look at what other states, for instance, what Texas has passed, what Idaho's passed, what Illinois has passed, and derive policy from that as well?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. Like I said, I mean, it's also guided by principles and mission statement. In terms of this issue of franchise, the question was limited to franchising, I understand. In terms of the franchising issue, which we're still developing policy on, we certainly will look at Texas. There was also legislation introduced in Virginia and New Jersey that was not successful. We'll take a look at the full range of issues. We certainly were also monitoring what's going on the Hill with the federal bills on this particular issue. We like to bring all of our members together in the task force, and sometimes we have just knocked down, dragged down fights, and sometimes it's a little bit smoother, but some of these issues really are contentious.
Sure.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I got to say, Representative Hilty brought up a great question that I think we need to talk about, because this isn't just about business, it's about social policy, and sometimes with the best of intentions, I think we get stuck in the mud or defend things that may have passed us by. And I just want to share one anecdotal story that may lead to some other discussion about this whole deregulation business. Back when the rails were being laid across the prairie and the government was giving away corridors and land, one of the requirements they had, at least in some of the prairie states, was that every town had to be, every farmer had to be no more than one day's drive with a team of horses and a wagon from a railroad. And so you had branch lines sprouting up all over the place, and that was a government requirement that would meant to help settle the prairie and make it economically possible for farmers to get their goods to market. Whenever the Staggers Rail Deregulation Act hit in 1978, which I think was the first of the big deregulation bills that started a whole new way of the government looking at how they control the marketplace or whether that was even a good thing. One thing that Staggers did was lift that off the railroads and allow them to actually start justifying their expenses and whether or not small towns deserve to have two or three railroad lines running through them, if one at all, because counties and cities were doing things like building roads to 10-ton standards. Trucking companies came along shortly after the railroad deregulation came truck deregulation. So I guess one of the things we have to ask ourselves, and maybe it's a good thing for us as policymakers to consider, is what about the universal service standard? What is it we're actually trying to accomplish? What about 911? What is it we're actually trying to accomplish? Has the technological marketplace passed us by, and are we still stuck in a railroad every 7 miles so that a team and wagons can still get there in 2006? I just want to challenge us to think about these things, folks. Is a pair of copper wires to every house something that we have a desire to enforce on people? And if we do, what happens then whenever truckers can run into a small town and the little grain elevator now starts buying its transportation services, which really is what this was all about? Not about railroads, it was about transportation, it was about access. All of a sudden trucks are blowing railroads out of the water and people aren't using boxcars anymore. Is this where we want to go? We need to think about what it is we want universal service for. Are there companies, is there technology out there that can make it possible so we don't have to have rails on ties every 7 miles? I guess that's what I want to think about. And as we're thinking about this deregulation business here, maybe there's some parallels we can draw from the government owning infrastructure that allows all comers to play, for instance, waterways, airways and airports, highways. Private companies provide outstanding service at very competitive rates, and they can enter and exit the market as they see fit, not as we see fit, or regulators we hire see fit. Has this happened in telecommunications? And I don't want us to think about a dial tone again, a pair of copper wires so we can call grandma, but we got to think about everything now that's coming down the pike, whether it's a picture, whether it's sound, data, voices, whatever it is. How does it get to us? What parallels can we draw whenever they deregulated railroads and trucks and airplanes and pipelines and so on and so forth, that we can pick up on the successes there and apply it to this industry? Where were the pratfalls so that we don't have to trip over the same things again, I guess? That's, So I'm really glad, Representative Hilde, you brought up the universal service business, and I just want to add the 911 business in there, too. Is there a way to provide that, that we don't have to be taxing the urban areas to support the rural areas? I would like to see us explore that a little further.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keegan, I have a little different tack on questioning here. You mentioned that six states had passed legislation to ease regulations this year: Alabama, Idaho, Iowa, Oregon, Tennessee, and Utah. And you talk a little more about policy changes. I have a kind of a structure question. And were those states that changed their policies on relating to regulation, did they also change the regulatory structure? Can you compare, do those states have a public utilities commission, or is the regulatory entity a commerce department, or how do those compare with Minnesota, or did they change the entity who does the regulation as well?
Mr. Egan.
Yes, the six states had a regulatory entity similar to a PUC, like you have here. Were there reforms, besides getting them out of the rate regulation business, there weren't structural, excuse me, there weren't significant structural reforms. It's interesting, you know, we talk about states and also at the federal level, you know, that there certainly has been calls, there have been calls to reform the FCC, and I think calls also to reform PUCs. In terms of you're getting out of rate regulation business, not requiring companies to seek rate review, that's an important change, but it certainly isn't a structural change. I don't know, to be honest with you, if those states really thought hard about completely reforming their regulatory entities. Certainly wanted to keep in place something, you know, to handle fraud and consumer issues and to act as the referee. But I don't believe that in either one of those they considered drastic reforms.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does your organization have like a summary of some of these, how it's structured in states that we could look at, or do you keep kind of a? You can provide that to us. You don't need to do it right now, but that would be good information, I think.
Do you have a way, Mr. Keegan, of that you compile that information at all? Or?
That shouldn't be too hard. I'm happy to pull together that. We for the most part, we track the legislation because it is of interest to us. And I think the other thing to point out, because it is an important point for me to make, you know, all these various organizations can look the same and feel the same after a while. And by organizations, I mean ALEC and NCSL and any number of other associations and organizations. We are most certainly not a lobbying organization. We're a 501c3 educational organization. We track these issues because, you know, they're of interest to the organization and of interest to our members. But you know, I certainly don't spend a lot of time, as you can probably figure out from my stammering here through some of these. I'm not a professional testifier. I don't go out and to states and try to sell them on anything. You know, we do follow these issues with interest, and it shouldn't be too hard to gather that information and provide it for you. So I'm happy to do that.
If you could do that and follow up with Brian, yeah, on our staff here, and Bob, and then we'll get that out to the rest of the committee, that'd be great.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Getting back to the Universal Service Fund and the rural issues, what have you heard being discussed to deal with the rural metro line disparities? I mean, the number of customers per line in Minneapolis or Washington, D.C. is different than Hinkley or Elbow Lake, Minnesota. What have you heard? I mean, at some point it seems like you've got to have something to, and you talk about growing up in three places in the mile, and we didn't have cable, that solely makes a maybe a good business decision, but as a social issue of where people can live, and if you don't have some of that infrastructure, it might affect where people are going to live or are able to live, and that's the balance that has to be sought, and that's why we have different policies in place to ensure that there's electric lines in rural Minnesota's, the REAs that came about some 60, 70 years ago, the access charges issue for smaller telecoms and all those different policies. But how do you reconcile them? Have you wrestled with that at all or looked at different policy suggestions?
Yes, sir. You discussed growing up in upstate New York and having three houses on a road and no cable service. That changed, unfortunately, after I moved out of the house when my parents bought a DirecTV. They bought a dish. Satellite penetration in the cable market has increased. So that's providing an alternate service that wasn't available at the time. And unfortunately, maybe I was born 10 years too early before I could fully enjoy the benefits of the dish at my parents' house. Mm-hmm. But certainly, one of the issues when we talk about universal service is inter-carrier compensation reform, and that's something that is ongoing. The FCC, they proposed a new rulemaking to try to address some of these issues, because inter-carrier compensation reform, is tied to universal service. Inter-carrier compensation, when we talk about access charges, which long-distance companies pay to local phone companies for use of their networks. The funds from that, in many cases, also help to subsidize not only the upkeep and the maintenance of the network and the equipment and the technology, but can also underwrite the cost of serving sparsely populated areas. That's something that's going forward. I know some of the other stakeholders are here are going to have a strong position on this. It certainly is worth watching, and we are looking at what the FCC is doing. The proposed rulemaking came out in March, I believe it was March of this year. This also follows up. The FCC reduced access charges in 2000, and that had an effect on local on states and localities. As it relates to inter-carrier compensation reform, the FCC rulings, there are several companies, large and small, that are participating in a coalition, and they've developed at least a proposal that's out there. It's called, I've got it written down here, so I apologize. It's a bill and keep regime that would seeks to define the points of interconnection and financial obligations. Supporters argue they'll preserve and enhance universal service, facilitate carrier efforts to innovate and offer new services, minimize the need for regulation by eliminating inter-carrier disputes, and allow consumers and carriers to adjust expectations of business plans by implementing new inter-carrier compensation and universal service structures over a reasonable transition period. That's just what they've said. But that is highly controversial. I know at least some of the people that will be speaking next will take a very different position from that. It certainly merits further attention. We'll keep an eye on it, certainly. Yeah, universal service, it does get tied up in some other issues as well, other policy discussions. But as I said before, I think it's an important policy goal. The question, the funding issue, while certainly not insignificant, is something that can be addressed, and there have been proposals, like I mentioned earlier, to broaden the base through either general tax revenues or to provide per customer charge. So those are some of the ways that people are looking at the financing, the funding issue.
Mr. Keegan, I got one last question, and we don't have any other questions, I don't believe. Representative Lanning will, I guess, after me, but shifting into the wireless discussion that you touched on, What was the drive behind lifting regulations in the wireless field, and what do you see coming down with consumer protection issues on in that area? 2 years ago, we passed a bill that dealt with contracts and contract changing consumer protection issues, and that's still tied up in the courts right now. Two prongs. What led to the lifting of the regulations from what you've studied, and what do you see coming, if anything, with states or the federal government, or who's going to have the consumer protection oversight?
Sure. In terms of the rationale in the mid-90s, I unfortunately was not doing this back then. I can't tell you a great deal about why they did it. I think my own view is when we talk about some industries and how they were regulated and how they were deregulated, and when we look at some international comparisons, particularly on broadband, you realize that wireline is a very old, mature industry. And so some of these new technologies that were not really born and created in the old regulatory regime, just didn't have to, haven't had the same history as the wireline telephones. Mm-hmm. Wireless telephones were not really available really until the mid-90s. They were sporadically. One of the funny examples I always think of when I look at my tiny little cell phone is Ruby Wall Street in 1987, when Michael Douglas is on the beach with a cell phone that's about the size of a toaster. Mm-hmm. It was massive. They certainly were not readily available. They were not widely, they were not consumer products by and large. So I don't know if it was just foresight that someone recognized the potential of the industry. I wish I could give a little bit more insight as to the whys. But certainly that opening up the spectrum, lifting some of the number of competitors, the limitation on the number of competitors, had a profound effect. And as a parent, I sometimes lament the fact that wireless is as ubiquitous as it is and everything else, because as the father of a daughter, albeit she's only four, I lament the day in about 10 years when I don't have control over the telephone. It's one of the few areas of control that the parents have. So certainly it's an industry that has taken off, and as rates have fallen and services have gotten better, an industry that was allowed to mature kind of outside of the same regulatory restraints as wireline phones. Consumer protections within the wireless industry, I think some of the complaints are certainly issues with signal strength, and I know there's some other issues as well. I want to say that's actually that's the FCC and their wireless, I believe, handles those kinds of complaints. I don't know if there's anything at the state level. To be honest, I apologize for not knowing that. But
okay. Representative Lenny.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Keegan, for your helpful testimony here this morning. I think it's important for us to keep in mind that while there are some regulatory issues that cut across all of the different services we're talking about here, there are some unique characteristics with each one of them. And one example of that I'm thinking of is cable television. And I know something that's very important to a lot of communities is the public access channel and the regulation that requires that, along with the franchise fees that can be charged in association with the franchise that's issued. Can you talk a little bit about what is or isn't happening on a national level with regard to those issues related to cable television specifically?
Mr. Keegan.
Sure. The federal bills I referenced earlier touch on the franchising issue in terms of allowing primarily telephone providers into the video marketplace. This is something that had has resided in cities and localities to provide that. I would imagine that there would still be a place for some of those issues at the state level. You'd be merely getting a franchise from the state, ostensibly the PUC or the entity that handles telecommunications issues. So there would still be, I believe, a state role in that. And I should say too, I mean, some providers that are looking to get into the video marketplace have said that, you know, they would abide by the existing rules, that their concern is not necessarily to try to circumvent the rules, but rather to be able to obtain a single franchise without having to go to municipality after municipality, to get, because I think the other thing is, I mean, the franchising, in terms of actually getting the franchise authority, besides just the sheer numbers of it, if you're going to provide in multiple states, it's also the amount of time that it takes to actually get the license and everything that goes with that. So, there are providers out there who have said they would abide by all those obligations, that they are really interested in just being able to seek a single franchise instead of having to go to city to city.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative.
Thank you. Do you see any real threat to loss of public access through various efforts to deregulate here?
I don't think so. I think the threat to some of the public access comes from a different angle. There have been proposals and discussion at the federal level to mandate a la carte pricing structures, basically, that would allow people, instead of buying the level, the tiers that they buy, basic, I forget what the tiers are, to basically allow them to pick and choose which channels they want to pay for, they want to subscribe to. It has a lot of appeal to people on a lot of levels. If I get 100 channels, I may only watch 7 or 8, and I could easily live without a lot of the other channels that are out there. The flip side is, and then the analysis that's been done on it by the FCC and by other GAO and other private sector consulting firms' analysis, has been that a la carte actually raises prices dramatically. And what you would find is that certain niche channels, certain niche networks wouldn't exist. They just wouldn't be able to generate the advertising revenue. There would be major profit losses, and so public access is one of those that it's almost inconceivable to imagine how a public access channel exists if there's a la carte pricing that goes on. As of yet, there hasn't been federal legislation. There were discussions earlier this year. I don't believe that a bill was actually was a bill that was introduced, but its prospects aren't very good. But I think more so than actual franchising, I think it's the a la carte approach actually presents a greater danger to some of the public access that you described.
Thank you. One last follow-up question, if I might. What about threats to local communities, or in the case of the state, collecting any tax on these services? In the state of Minnesota, we collect a tax that helps support Minnesota Relay services to hearing impaired people, as an example. Or a local community or a state, for that matter, having some kind of tax that would help pick up the cost of 911 services or expansion of that service. Could you speak to that issue as it relates to deregulation and what to watch out for, or what are the threats, if any, that you see?
Sure.
Mr. Keegan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Proponents will say of video franchising in particular that if I'm paying 5% to every municipality and I just pay 5% to the state, that's still the same 5%. It's just collected by a single source instead of potentially hundreds of sources. So an immediate, depending on then how you get that money back to localities, which I think would be the goal, to make them whole so they don't lose 5% of their revenue stream. I'm assuming states would want to provide some kind of either rebate mechanism or some way to get that money back to the localities. People say that 5% is 5%, and the dollar amounts don't change. It's just to who the money goes to, and then on your end, how it's then filtered back down to the cities. So, I wouldn't envision that there would be a major revenue impact with video franchising.
Thank you, Mr. Keegan. There's no other questions. What I'm anticipating to do is just have some brief comments from the different interest groups that would like to comment on the telecom issue and some of your remarks, as well as we want to thank you for your insight and putting this information together for us and coming here from Washington. We had also tried to get a counter, another person that does similar work from the NCSL. We were never able to, never heard back from them in a timely fashion, and it didn't work for the people that had suggested to come at the time that they finally we heard back from them. Just so and members know that at one time was the plan, is to bring even another person like yourself in and have a discussion from them as well. But this was great. Thank you for coming. And if there's other questions that arise through the next half hour of discussion, we might call you back up here. But thank you. And maybe I'll start with Mr. Knickerbocker from MTA, and then if Randy Young from MART would have some comments, and Mike Martin from the cable industries, or if you want to, well, let's have Mr. Knickerbocker come first, and then if there's anybody else that would like to just comment, please send a note up front here. Sign up on the sheet, and we do have time for any consumer protection concerns or wireless. If there's somebody here from the wireless, we would welcome brief comments from you as well. We didn't hear back from folks in that industry, so hopefully somebody's here. If you are, please let us know. Mr. Knickerbocker. You know the routine? State your name. If you can sign the record also for us, that'd be much appreciated.
Sure.
And I guess to give you some guidance, we'll just open it up for some Q&A after some comments from you, if there is. I guess just some of your thoughts in the regulation, deregulation issue. It's been something that you, as you know, has been around this capital for several years. This year, again, we ran into some sticky wickets, and as we have in the past, what are your thoughts? What needs to be changed or looked at more seriously, and what doesn't need to be changed, or the status quo fine right now, and any other responses you have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Jerry Knickerbocker. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Telecom Alliance, which is a trade group of the 92 local phone companies in the state. We also have some CLEC members, as well as some wireless members, and a number of associated members who supply the industry. We need help with the issues that have been discussed this morning, and what I was asked to do is to respond to the presenter. You all are very aware that we had two pieces of legislation last session, one of which would have deregulated services here in the state of Minnesota, that Representative Hoppe carried, mm-hmm. and a bill that would have removed some of the barriers to entry for telcos into the cable area. Our cable laws are terribly outdated and would have made some modest changes that would have speeded up competition coming in the providing of cable. But I need to go back and I think make clear when people say deregulation, you know, that means lots of different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that everybody understands that the wireline telephone companies or the local LECs are the only ones that are still regulated. The state, it doesn't regulate cable, it doesn't regulate long distance carriers, it doesn't regulate ISPs, it doesn't regulate wireless, voice over IP, or any of the new technologies that are coming out there. So wireline phone companies are regulated by the state of Minnesota. And when we talk about deregulation, we're talking about being able to compete with all of our new competitors and all of the new service providers who are providing telecommunication services but are not regulated. The problem we have being wireline companies, I mean, we're left over from 1934 Act and the other things that have come since that time. Regulation has been by the type of company that provides the service. And that doesn't fit in 2005. If you decide, you, the Minnesota legislature, that something needs to be regulated, you ought to regulate it by service. That this is valuable and therefore that needs regulation. Not by the type of company that provides the service. So we're operating in that environment. We're the only ones left in the box, so to speak, that are regulated. We need some relief to compete with all of our unregulated competitors in 2005 and going forward. And the bill that the MTA introduced last session with Representative Poppy as the chief author would have deregulated, you know, provisioning of services in the state of Minnesota. But, you know, we made a conscious effort to try to address the concerns that people would have about consumer protection and providing, you know, basic service everywhere in the state to those people that didn't want advanced services and only wanted to basically, you know, have phone service and be connected to the public switch network. And that's what that bill did. It provided that local exchange carriers had to offer that basic black box service in all of the exchanges in which they provided service. The PUC and the Department of Commerce would still have the ability to oversee the provisioning of services. There'd be the provisioning of complaint procedures, everything stays in place, so that if there are complaints about the type of service, quality of service, and or the price, there is a way for people to come and express their concerns, and the regulators could still, you know, basically make sure that that basic level of service is going to be there everywhere in the state. But, you know, if the company had its choice, wanted to be, you know, deregulated and offer deregulated services for everything else, it could do so. And that's really the key. I mean, wireline companies need the ability to compete today in 2005 and going forward, the ability to bundle services and the ability to price their services depending on what's going on in the marketplace and who they have to compete with. We don't have that ability and have the ability to move fast at the present time under the present circumstances. And really that's what deregulation kind of is about for wireline companies. Now, let me move over here to the other side when we talk about, you know, the differences in terms of a definition of deregulation. The other people that are unregulated are concerned about being regulated, and they don't want to be, and that's understandable. And all the discussion that you've got going on the federal level now is about unraveling regulation and or whether or not voice over IP or advanced broadband services or new technologies that might evolve that we don't even know about, Wi-Fi, WiMAX, the ISP providers, you know, the internet telephone systems, whether or not there needs to be any kind of regulation or taxation of those services like the wireline companies. And there's just kind of a whole bunch of competing views about how to do that or whether you should do that or whether you ought not do it at all. And that's one of those things that's going to get thrashed out on the federal level. We'll have no control over that. But that is a separate issue about, you know, the definition of deregulation. Now, for our part, the wireline companies that are regulated by the local PUCs, and state PUCs, I should say, in their respective states, we have to compete with all those other people out there that are unregulated, offering these niche services, taking away our customers. So we do need tools to compete, and you have to give us the tools to compete. And deregulation is one of them, and the bill that was introduced last legislative session goes a long way towards meeting the needs of the wireline companies going forward. The other piece of legislation that I might mention that was kind of talked about here was the bill that was introduced last session that we worked on with the League of Cities that would remove some of the barriers to entry to allow a greater flexibility for municipalities to grant a second cable franchise. And that was a pretty modest step. That's nowhere near the way in which Texas went about making competition happen in the cable industry. And I think that issue, you know, is now being teed up on the federal level. And as the previous speaker has said, there are a number of issues that are being teed up on the federal level, both with the rewrite of the Federal Act, the 96 Act, as well as the FCC. The FCC's got a number of dockets open, a big one on air carrier compensation that will maybe have some sort of an impact on the high cost fund, the E-rate fund for schools and libraries. And basically, they're trying to get their arms around the size of the fund, because it was never intended to be used for all of the sources that it is being used for at the present time. And whether or not we're going to be able to have affordable services and service for rural Minnesota, you know, is tied up in that discussion of intercarrier compensation at the FCC. I think that's probably, Mr. Chairman, a good place for me to stop. I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of the things that the previous speaker has brought up or anything that
question I have. Thank you, Mr. Knickerbocker. Are you familiar with what Texas did in opening up the cable competition?
I've read a summary of the bill.
Okay.
But I'll just stop there. I've read a summary of the bill. And I should mention, Mr. Chairman, that Texas picked up the good points from Representative Beard's bill.
So there was bad points in it, too? Any other questions for Mr. Knickerbocker? Thank you, Mr. Knickerbocker, and Mr. Young, Randy Young,
members.
Mike Martin, I'll have you come next for the cable industry. Mr. Young, you know the routine as well. Please introduce yourself and sign in, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Randy Young, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Association for Rural Telecommunications. We represent the rural independent telephone companies in the state, the family-owned and co-ops that serve about half the geography of Minnesota, but only about 10 or 12% of the customers. I'd like to maybe just spend a couple of minutes elaborating a little bit on some of the points that Mr. Keegan made and Mr. Knickerbocker made as well, particularly in the light of competition in rural communities. Today, our rural telephone companies are facing competition from a number of different sources. No longer are we the only provider of telecommunication services, whether they be basic services or advanced services in our communities. Today, we're facing competition from the wireless industry, from the cable industry, and from numerous ISPs and broadband internet providers. Today, there are more wireless phone numbers in Minnesota than there are wireline phone numbers. Wireless has taken off. It has become a competitive force in rural Minnesota, just as it is in the metropolitan area. The industry did a survey of the independent companies about a year ago, and whereas in previous years we were showing either a slow or a moderately good growth in the number of access lines that we had, today, for the most part, we're either seeing our companies with a level number of access lines or actually a decrease in the number of access lines. In good measure, that is due to the competition that we're facing from the wireless industry and from the cable industry. From our perspective, MART's perspective, we've seen that firsthand. Our dues are based on the number of access lines that our companies have. And for the last couple of years, as we've gotten our dues in, we've seen the numbers go down. Now, maybe my guys are just trying to stiff me, I'm not sure. But I do think that it does carry forward into the surveys that we've seen, that we are losing access lines to that competition. And as Mr. Knickerbocker had indicated, it's difficult when we are the only regulated player in the marketplace and our competitors in the telecommunications field are not regulated, to be able to meet the marketplace and meet the competition in a timely manner when we have the regulatory constraints that our competitors don't have. Regarding federal legislation, I think I agree with Mr. Keegan, although he may be a little optimistic that there'll be a bill in 2006. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes beyond that. One of the things that we are very concerned about is that the protections that the 96 Act had in protecting rural customers is continued in the rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. When the big players start to dance, we're a little concerned that us little guys may get trampled in the big deals that are made among the national and the big players. Luckily, the Rural Caucus in the U.S. House has taken this issue as an important issue to rural America. And in fact, Congressman Gutnick from Minnesota is co-chairing the Telecommunications Subcommittee of the Rural Caucus and has taken a particular interest in making sure that the protections that rural Americans and rural Minnesotans have under the 96 Act will be continued in any rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. And a number of their members, in fact, three of our delegation, Congressman Gutnick, Congressman Oberstar, and Congressman Peterson, have all signed on to a policy statement that the Rural Caucus has regarding universal service and other issues in any rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. And if you don't have a copy of that, I'd be glad to give you a copy of both those who signed the principles and what the principles are. They basically fall, if you'd like me to go into a little bit of detail on that, the primary interest, of course, for rural Minnesotans and rural Americans in the rewrite of the 96 Act is a continuation of the Universal Service Act. Minnesota does not have a Universal Service Fund. We rely on the Federal Universal Service Fund, and in fact, that generates about $80 million a year coming into Minnesota out of that fund to support high-cost rural customers. In Minnesota, the small independent telephone companies basically have three sources, and they're relatively equal, of the revenue stream. About a third of our revenues come from the rates that we get from our customers for basic service. About a third of the revenues come from the Universal Service Fund. And the third element of our support for the infrastructure comes from the access charges, as Mr. Keegan had indicated, from the long-distance companies and others that use our network to begin and to complete their customers' telephone calls. The customers alone could not afford the cost of basic service in Minnesota. On average, for the independent telephone companies, the cost is about $13-$14 a month for basic service. If you looked at the actual cost for providing that service, depending on where the company is located and how sparsely populated their service area is, it can run anywhere from $50 up to close to $100 a month just for basic service. Obviously, that's a cost that most rural Minnesotans couldn't afford to pay. As a result, the Universal Service Fund and access charges have allowed us to keep our rates reasonable and affordable for our rural citizens in the state. We think the Universal Service Fund ought to be continued. We agree with the Rural Caucus that it ought to be funded through the industry. It shouldn't be a part of the general revenue at the federal level. That it should be assessed to all segments of the communications industry, all the players should be paying into the fund, and that all the players should be able to draw out of the fund as well. It shouldn't just be the landline companies that draw out of the Universal Service Fund. If you're providing service in rural America and rural Minnesota, and you're an ETC, you should be able to draw out of the fund. The problem that we have right now with how the money is drawn out of the fund is a decision that the FCC made that those that draw out of a fund draw out at the rate of investment that the incumbent landline company made. So, for example, if a wireless company comes into a community, puts up a tower for $300,000 and begins to compete with us and is declared an ETC by the Public Utilities Commission, they don't draw out of that fund on the cost of their $300,000 tower. They draw out of the fund based on the cost that our companies invested in the landline network that could be millions of dollars. We think that that's an inequity, it's a windfall for the wireless companies, and it unreasonably draws down on a capped fund, making those scarce funds even more scarce. So we think that each provider ought to draw out of the fund based on their own investment of infrastructure in their communities. And then finally, we think that that the fund ought to be not only in today's economy and with today's technology for basic plain old POTS telephone service, but it also ought to be used for advanced services too. Rural Minnesotans, rural Americans need and deserve the advanced technologies that everyone else needs today as well. So we think that it ought to be expanded to include advanced technologies. The Rural Caucus's principles for a Rewrite Act dealing with rural customers also believes that everyone that uses the network and this gets access charges ought to be compensating for their use of the network. If you're using somebody's facilities, you ought to be paying for the use of that facilities. Now, we can quibble about what is a fair payment, but the fact remains that if somebody is invested in facilities and somebody else is using those, they ought to be paying for the use of them. Today we've got somewhat of a problem in Minnesota as well as elsewhere with what we call phantom traffic. And those through arbitrage and the gaming of the system are literally using the network for nothing. Now, studies that we've done indicate that anywhere upwards of 20% of the traffic that's flowing through some of our switches is phantom traffic, and we're not collecting any payment for the use of our network for that traffic. The federal principles of the Rural Caucus, as well as the industry here in Minnesota, feels that if you're using the network, you ought to be paying your fair share for the continuation of the network. We hear comments about, well, we have all these new technologies, voice over internet and these other things that are coming along, so we don't need your network anymore. What do we need those old wires out there running around rural Minnesota for? The fact of the matter is all of these new whiz-bang technologies can't operate without the network that is in place today. They may be using the network differently than is being used today for plain old telephone service, but nonetheless, if that network is not there, or if that network decays, all of these fancy new services won't be able to be provided throughout rural Minnesota either. Again, in network access and connectivity, we think that there should be an obligation that anyone that's a player, anyone that's providing telecommunications or communication services, should be obligated to connect up with everybody else so that we, again, continue to have one seamless network in this country and not a bunch of bifurcated networks that can't talk with each other, nor can their customers communicate with each other. And again, that there is a principle that advanced broadband services should be available throughout the country and throughout Minnesota in rural areas as well as in metropolitan areas. Those are the principles that the Rural Caucus has developed. We will be watching those principles obviously closely, and any activities to rewrite the federal 1996 Telecommunications Act. That will have an extreme impact on rural Minnesota as much as any issues that you may face here in Minnesota at the Minnesota legislature. Historically, Minnesota and the legislature has recognized the difference between the rural independent telephone companies in the state and the larger telephone companies. You have recognized the wisdom of regulating us differently than the larger players. That has been true at the federal level as well. As a result, we have had historically less regulation than the larger companies, but nonetheless today when we're in a marketplace where our primary competitors are not regulated and we are, it makes it difficult for us to compete in a timely manner in that kind of a market when we've got the regulatory constraints that we have today. Unlike the large companies, our primary form of regulation is what we call coffee shop regulation. We live in our communities, we do business on Main Street, we see our customers every day in the coffee shops and at church and elsewhere, and we hear from our customers what they need, what we're doing well, and what we're not doing so well. That has been the most effective form of regulation that we've found in responding to the needs of our communities. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to stand for any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Any questions? Representative Thiessen and then Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably don't know enough about this as I should, but we're talking a lot about marketplaces here and how those are operating. I guess I have two questions. One is you made a comment about the current lines that you have going on is what's going to be needed to handle the other technologies for communications. And if you could expand on that, because I, for instance, wireless wouldn't rely on your lines. And I would also guess that broadband, although probably it's not out in some of the areas that you serve, those types of, or those lines that would serve that type of technology wouldn't necessarily use your line. So if you could just expand on that a little bit, and then also explain to me a little bit about the background of why the companies or the groups that you represent formed, and why there's not been, it sounds like there's not been as much consolidation as we've seen perhaps in some of the other telecommunications markets, and if you could explain some of the reason for that.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen. Actually, wireless as well as wireline, VoIP, and the others all use our networks.
If they're communicating with a landline phone?
Even beyond that.
Okay.
There's a misconception that I talk on my cell phone here and it goes through the air and goes to your cell phone over there. Actually, a very small percentage of the area that's traversed by that phone call is wireless. It goes from my phone to a tower, down that tower, into the wireline network, over to another tower, up and then over to your phone call. So even though it may be a wireless to wireless phone call, it still uses the traditional network for the bulk of the distance that it travels. Regarding broadband, today 90% of the customers served by the independent telephone companies here in Minnesota have got access to broadband services. We literally have got resorts and cabin owners that live on islands in Lake of the Woods that have got broadband available to them today. For the most part, that's done over the twisted pair copper that's in the ground. There are distance limitations of, depending on what kind of DSL you're using, 3,000 to 5,000 feet that you can just use the copper. But what we have been doing, our companies have been doing, is as we go out into the countryside, we'll put fiber out into the countryside to get within that 5,000 feet of the farmsteads and our other customers, and then be able to provide that broadband service. A lot of our competitors that are providing broadband in our community are using our networks to get to their customers as well. So there often is a misconception that all of these other technologies don't need the existing network, but in fact they all do. And if the existing network decays because there aren't adequate funds to keep it maintained the way it is today or even to improve it, all these other technologies that we're using will decay as well and won't be available in rural Minnesota. Your second question again?
Had to do with why there's how it's worked out that there's so many kind of independent phone companies.
Not the mergers in the smaller companies.
No one has ever been able to explain to me well why close to a third of all of the telephone companies in the country are in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. There's an anomaly. I used to teach a telecommunications regulatory class at St. Mary's, and I promised anyone who could give me the answer would get an A for the class and wouldn't have to come back. And no one's been able to give you a decent answer as to why close to a third of the companies are in three contiguous states. Part of it may be the attitude that we have up here. At one time, there were over 2,000 independent telephone companies in Minnesota, and that wasn't too many years ago. A lot of them were called what are, were called farmer line companies, where farmers would get together, literally use the barbed wire to connect up to a little switch that would then connect up to a phone company. Those consolidated over the years so that today they're, depending on how you count, 70 or 80 independent telephone companies in the state. About a third of them are co-ops, about two-thirds of them are still family-owned. They range in size from the smallest being up in Wawena, Minnesota, with about 55 customers. It's a husband and wife, teacher. They literally run it out of their home. They have fiber. They have a digital switch.
Where's that?
Wawena, Minnesota. Northern part of the state.
All right.
To maybe the larger ones that maybe have maybe 20,000 customers. There's not a high demand among the large RBOX and larger companies to buy the independent telephone companies. Actually, is what we're seeing is the opposite happen, as the RBOX want to concentrate in the larger metropolitan areas. They're attempting to sell their rural exchanges. And we've been looking at, when possible, buying those exchanges and providing the level of service we do in our own communities to those communities as well. We've seen a bit of consolidation within the independent telephone companies as families have decided the next generation doesn't want to run the telephone company, or for economies of scale, mergers. It hasn't been widespread. There have just been a few. But for the most part, they've been able to do well because of the three prongs of financing that we have, the Universal Service Fund, access charges, and the rates that we charge our customers, to make a decent living, as well as to provide those advanced services, as 90% of our customers have DSL today.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to your statement about, you said 20, or you estimated 20% of the traffic traveling through your switches is phantom traffic. Is this, first question, is this pirate traffic? Is this illegal that you know, people aren't supposed to be doing this? Or is it just due to your current system and structure you're unable to collect on it? And secondly, who are the people that are sort of guilty of this? Is it a certain industry? Is it people using the system for a certain type? The reason I ask these questions, I suspect if that 20% were changed, it would be a different situation for your industry. I mean, 20% of the calls would be, I suppose, substantial revenue. So those two questions for you, please.
And third on that question, because you took the question out of my mouth, is there something we can do at the state and examine to help deal with it, at least in the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, part of it is polluted traffic, if you will, and there are a number of ways that that's happening. Back when the network was created many years ago, there were few players. It was basically a gentleman's handshake. Not a whole lot of contracts were written. Everyone knew each other. There were agreements made, and it all worked well. As we've gotten into a much larger industry with many new players, the old way of doing business doesn't work in the new era. And we're finding folks today that are gaming the system, for example, routing traffic out of the country and then back into the country to avoid access charges, not putting the information on the call when it comes in, going through the network, saying where it came from, so we don't know who to bill for the traffic. And we're obligated to deliver that traffic whether we get paid for it or not. If one of our little old lady grandmothers, if you will, doesn't pay her bill, after a certain period of time, we can cut her off for not paying her bill. Unfortunately, if a big company doesn't pay their bill of hundreds of thousands of dollars, we can't cut them off. We have to continue to provide service to their customers through them. I'm not sure that even if we could legally cut them off, we would want to do that, because that's affecting our customers as well. Those are long-distance phone calls that are coming into our customers or that our customers are making, and I'm not sure we'd want to do it. But nonetheless, we do have that obligation to continue that traffic, even if we're not getting paid for it, because they're not providing us with the information. In some situations with some of the wireless companies, we've been able to negotiate contracts with them to get access charges for their traffic. In other situations, quite frankly, they haven't wanted to come to the bargaining table to sit down and negotiate. So we're delivering their traffic and not getting compensated for it. We have had discussions within the industry, and we were very close to having a bill introduced two sessions ago dealing with this. Unfortunately, it was too late in the session, so we weren't able to get it introduced. There is still a docket open at the PUC. Hopefully, it'll get addressed at the administrative level so that it won't have to be addressed here at the legislature.
Mr. Young, on that same note, one of the issues I've heard is the payment by the wireless not the access charge, but the what's the negotiated rate between cell companies and landline companies. It's a lower rate than the access charges, and I'm drawing a blank on that term right now, but is that still a problem with wireless companies not being able to be collected from by some phone landline companies?
Mr. Chair, we have been able to negotiate with many of the wireless companies. With some, we have not been able to negotiate with. And maybe to follow up on the comment that Representative Lesch had made, if we were getting compensated for all the traffic that we're carrying, we could reduce the excess charge rate so that we wouldn't have huge disparities. And some of the issues that we have with the long-distance companies regarding excess charges maybe would be minimized.
Thanks. Any other questions, members? Mr. Young, thank you. If you get a bill or get some of those issues put together, let us know, and as we progress along and decide as a committee what if anything, we want to or will take a look at in the telecom area, we'd hope to bring those issues forward if that happens to occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Martin, representing the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, or the trade group of cable companies in Minnesota. Thank you. Just a few comments as a follow-up to the speaker. Yes, there is a very, very active effort at the federal government to revise telecom law. Until the hurricanes, we really thought that something would pass this year, as the speaker indicated. There's a number of important issues on the table there. Some are not sure what they are. They're committee bills that are being drafted, so we haven't seen the specifics. There's bills that authorize and reiterate municipal authority to enter the telecommunications market. There's bills that prohibit municipal entry into the telecommunications market. The broadcasters have measures which they've introduced as part of this reform dealing with our must-carry obligations. Cable television companies have rather extensive obligations on what programming must be carried, what local broadcasters must be carried, and the broadcasters have issues. And then, of course, there's the so-called national franchising issues, which have been introduced, and others I think were referred to, the a la carte issue and some of those others. I don't know what's going to happen on those. There's a lot of discussion. I know the cities are actively engaged in it. The cable television regulators met last week in Washington, and I believe that a big part of their meeting was devoted to preserving that authority. So Minnesota has actually taken that issue up in the past, the state franchising issue. At that time, we told members that we didn't think the state would ever really take over all franchising, that even if it encompassed all cable and telephone companies, that there would be residual authorities left to the cities, and that what we'd get is another layer of regulation, and that that concerned us. We could never be assured that the PUC, for example, if that were the agency, would have sole authority over franchising. Cable television is regulated at all levels. The FCC regulates cable television. Minnesota has probably the most extensive state law on cable television. Our law is very detailed. It's a law that sets out minimum standards for cable television franchises, and it's quite detailed. So we feel that we are regulated, certainly regulated as much as any other wire in the right of way. The local government, of course, there is a long tradition over the last. Well, the law was passed in 73, so we're looking at over 30 years, a tradition of very active municipal regulation in Minnesota. The cable companies have always responded to that and respected that authority, and have made those considerable investments in response to that regulatory scheme. So we're naturally very concerned about amendment suggestions, ideas that have been introduced that really ignore the investment that we've made, that ignore the very competitive nature of the video market. You know, today, I'm glad your speaker mentioned DirecTV, because that's our non-wire competitor. Satellite television, which is subject to no local regulation and no state regulation, serves about 28% of the households in Minnesota. That's a number that continues to go up. They're very aggressive, as you all know from their ads in their marketing, and they've had a great deal of success. 28% is a very, very significant portion of the market. Other issues I'd like to touch on. I'm glad Mr. Young mentioned the fact that the source of revenue for telephone companies, cable television companies derive all their revenue from their subscribers. I mean, that's where our revenue comes from. There's no subsidy mechanism. There's no universal service, anything like that. Our revenue, we go to the public markets to raise the capital and invest in the systems and operate that way. And I think that certainly should explain, you know, much of our resistance to some of these proposals, because we're not subsidized. We have no other mechanisms to underwrite our costs. Negotiate franchises with local government and accept the obligations of those local franchises, and we go from there. We're also seeing a lot of competition from wired companies. Certainly many of Mr. Knickerbocker's members are, through technology, advancements in technology, are able to provide video service. So as you go around the state, you'll see a lot of wireline video competition in communities like St. Cloud's, probably the biggest, Winona, Grand Rapids, Bemidji. I think we've identified 40 communities that have competitive franchises, either from telephone companies or co-ops or other municipal agencies. So those are some of the comments I'd like to make, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, members? Mr. Martin, the telephones that could or are competing with you, are they able to use any of those state dollars to enhance their technology or infrastructure pieces that they need to provide the cable on, or...
I'm not aware of any cable company that's been eligible for high cost reimbursement or.
But on the flip side, if a telephone company comes in and competes with you with cable, are they able to use the universal access funds or those other, any other funds as revenue to build their cable company?
Well,
are you subsidized that?
It's all on the same wire, so it's pretty hard to unscramble that egg.
Okay, sure.
I think if you're coming in and offering a service on your fiber
and sending video,
and 2/3 of your revenue is coming from outside sources, there is a certain advantage to that.
Sure. Okay. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barton, maybe I'd like to ask you to bounce the same question off you as off Mr. Keegan earlier. You're pretty dependent on franchise fees with cities. What is it that cities do for you that make them so valuable? And could you be in the marketplace without franchises with cities?
Mr. Martin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I heard you ask that question before, and that is a very good question. What is the value, I think, as you asked, what is the value of the franchise?
What's the value? What's valuable about it that makes it so attractive to you? And secondly, if they didn't exist, could you be in the market? Would there be a cable industry? Or how would it look?
Well, it's a whole system of regulation that was developed so that there would be an orderly deployment of a new technology. That's really the origin. There were really several factors going when these systems were developed. One was this idea of localism. You know, if you go back to when franchises were first being awarded, the sort of after the CATV days, where it wasn't just to get broadcast, where it was actually to get a new technology. What the cities wanted and what the communities that they represented wanted was diversity in the media. Those were the days that there were three networks and really three voices. And what communities wanted was an opportunity for diversity, for new voices and local voices. And so Minnesota in particular created a law to ensure that there would be local access and that there would be provision for this diversity. They didn't call it that then, but that's really what it was. And so to answer your question, I don't know. The idea of the franchise is this sort of orderly development, this contract with the city that says we will meet those needs, we will address those needs. It becomes the regulatory vehicle for that. So I don't have a yes or no. It's just the basis of the franchise.
Well, that's helpful to know some of that background. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Beard's question or point, for cities like mine that have a municipal electric, what we offered the cable company was the capacity to put their wires on the municipally owned utility poles. And so they couldn't have come in without a much heavier investment if they had not been granted that privilege by the city. So, you know, that may not be true for those who don't have municipal electric utility, but it certainly is for those of us who do.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Westrom. Mr. Martin, I have to plead ignorance, but I don't know when the law was created that allowed the minimum standards for franchises in Minnesota. Do you recall when that was created?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, 1973 was the first pass on it. The law that we have was really first introduced in 73. There were some amendments, I think, a few years after that were significant. But that law, just to take you back, created a cable board. We had active state certification of the franchise process. There was actually a citizen board appointed by the governor, and sort of looking over the city's shoulder is what it was doing to make sure that it had met those needs. And then as time went on, the board was abolished because most cities had gone through the franchise process and completed it. So,
any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody here from the wireless or anybody else that wants to testify? You heard from anybody?
While you're coming down, members, one of the things that strikes me on this telecom issue, and I'm interested in your feedback, is whether we're at a point where we should look at maybe developing a working group out of our committee that could hone the issues a little more, maybe dig a little deeper into what are some of the solutions, or what are some of the pros and cons of looking at some deregulation, et cetera, et cetera. I'm interested in your feedback. We can have just a brief discussion after this testifier, or also you can get back to me, but I'm not opposed to maybe setting up a working group if there's 5 or 7 committee members that would have an interest. Representative Thiessen, if members on your side can talk among yourself if we don't have a lot of discussion after this, or and let me know, let Ryan know. I'm looking for people's level of interest and in exploring these issues a little further, and I'm thinking maybe a working group would be a better way to go, and they could focus on some of these issues and maybe put together some draft bills or draft recommendations in the form of a bill to our committee. But I'm not ruling that out as an option, but if people aren't interested at all, then maybe we'll find other things to do. So, okay. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and sign in as well, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Megan Dobernick. I work with COVAD Communications Company. With me at the table is Jeff Oxley, who is the General Counsel of Echelon Communications, which, as you all know, is a Minnesota-based telecom company. We are here on behalf of the Minnesota CLEX, Competitive Local Exchange Companies, and the members of our group, COVAD and Echelon, already mentioned, as well as Integra Telecom, McLeod USA, TDS Metrocom, and XO Communications. Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout, which I think, as I pass out, will also help us expedite matters.
You can just put it on the end of the table. We can pass it around here.
And the clock has been ticking. You all have been sitting here for a very long time. So my goal, as I mentioned, I have a handout. It covers some of the information about our companies. I'll touch upon that briefly. But, Mr. Chairman, our understanding is what you all want to hear about is deregulation. Where do we come out on this issue, which is very important, and what are our thoughts about that? So that's where I'll focus.
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are a group of competitive telecommunications providers. We provide wireline. You've heard wireline and wireless, but we provide our services over the wireline network. And as the handout comes around, what you can see is we are companies. We are here in business in Minnesota, and we're very serious about our business here. We've put our money where our mouth is. We collectively have invested over $500 million in infrastructure in the state of Minnesota alone. We have collectively 1,100 employees on our payroll, which totals $75 million on an annual basis. And these jobs that we create and that we keep here in the state of Minnesota are not just any old jobs. Echelon, for example, their average salary on an annual basis is $50,000. So we are very serious about our business here in Minnesota. We also provide service not only in the Twin Cities, but in areas outside of the Twin Cities, such as Moorhead, Austin, St. Cloud, Brainerd, and Rochester. We are companies that have right now about 300,000 customers in the state of Minnesota. And we know that those customers, excuse me, I believe I said 300,000 companies. I meant 300,000 customers, excuse me. big thoughts here. But those 300,000 customers have chosen us specifically and not some other provider. And you have to ask yourself, well, what is it about our companies that made us unique, that made hundreds of thousands of customers choose us? And the answer is really simple. As a group, we are really focused on the small business market. And before our arrival, following the passage of the 1996 Telecom Act, frankly, small businesses didn't have a lot of choice. They were either offered telephone service like what you or I have at home, or they were offered a huge package, which is more appropriate for a company like 3M. When we came into business in this state, we said, no, here is a customer market that needs specialized products, specialized goods. And that's exactly what we did. We developed products and services that were tailored for these kinds of companies so they got what they needed at prices they could afford. So not only do we bring an economic benefit to you all in terms of what our companies have invested in our employee base, but I think it's important to know that we've provided goods and services that have helped hundreds of thousands of small businesses in this state really have an opportunity to thrive and prosper. So the economic benefits we bring go far beyond our companies, but we have been a real important catalyst in allowing small businesses to succeed in this state. And this is not just the products. As I mentioned, we provided it at prices that these companies can afford. And since our companies entered the business following 1996, what our research and information has shown is that small businesses and the prices they have paid for the telecommunication services they need and demand have fallen 5% year over year over year. So it's an incredible savings that we also offer. The question that is before us today is, well, what do we need to do? We have what appears to be some elements of the telecommunication industry regulated, others deregulated. Where do we fall out on this? Well, I'd like to dispel a couple of myths that I think have been repeated here today about deregulation. And the first one is, even under the regulatory scheme we have right now for the wireline companies, there is nothing out there that prevents any of us from offering new products, products that people, consumers, small businesses, large businesses want, or reducing our prices. Of course, at some point, you know, there's a rational economic constraint that says, well, if you offer that, you may go out of business. But today, in order to compete, we all have a huge arsenal of tools available to us in order to compete and compete successfully. The second thing that's unique about our companies and that I think you have certainly heard about earlier today is we do use the wireline networks of other companies. We've invested significantly in our own communications networks, but there are absolutely some things that we need from the incumbent wireline providers, and we pay for those elements that we use. It's not something that comes free. The costs, the rates that we pay to a company like Quest are designed to ensure that Quest recover its costs and also ensures a reasonable profit. And that's the federal pricing law standard that's applied in this state. I believe it might have been Representative Beard that talked about infrastructure and, you know, the highway system with private companies and trucks, you know, private trucks that provide service over a public highway system. I think Mr. Young also talked about, you know, wireline is special because everybody uses it, whether it's VoIP or broadband or wireless. There's something very unique about the wireline network that makes it similar to the highway system and that makes it so special and why we really should focus on that. And that's because we do all use it, and all of these other things that might otherwise be available would not be in the absence of a robust wireline network and the assurance that everybody, if they pay, certainly have no dispute that if we use it, we should pay, that we are able to use that in order to ensure that we can provide our services. And so when we get to the deregulation question, here you're talking about a group of companies that have clearly benefited from regulation. Regulation has helped our companies and it's provided a number of benefits, but we are not knee-jerk opposed to deregulation. What we are opposed to, and I think probably you would be as well because the issues go far beyond us, it goes to your constituents and 911 and universal service, you can't deregulate willy-nilly. I mean, what our message to you is, if you deregulate, it must be done in a responsible fashion. And in our handout, we've outlined a couple of the points that we think will ensure that any deregulation action taken, if you decide to take it at all, I don't think that's a foregone conclusion, but if you do choose to go down that path, there are a couple of things you need to keep in mind to ensure that your constituents, consumers, small businesses continue to get what they want and deserve, and that we continue to meet some very important public policy goals. And the things that we have identified that are critical to our ability to continue to provide service is, and this is down at the bottom of our handout, guaranteed and reliable access to the wholesale work network and enforceable performance standards. These, if we have that access and we are assured that that access will be provided in a way that allows us to compete in terms of service and timeliness and cost with the incumbent providers, then you will continue to have competitive choice in this state, particularly for small business and residential customers. And when we talk about the access part, I think that's pretty clear. We get to use it. But these enforceable performance standards, Mr. Chairman, you talked about consolidation in the industry. One of the downsides of consolidation is that you are now dealing with extremely large companies. And it is difficult to police really large companies so that they do not trample on small competitors. And the way to police it, at least at the state level, is to ensure that you really have a referee out there, that you have an entity, and in Minnesota it would be the Public Utilities Commission, that has the power, has the authority, has the wherewithal to say, wireline incumbent providers, when you provide these services, when you make this access available to your competitors, that you do so in a fashion that allows them to compete. And you have got to have that enforcement entity, because we alone don't have the size or the wherewithal or generally the ability to really duke it out with the big guys, because we haven't been around nearly as long and we don't have the resources.
Sure.
So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Thiessen.
Just a quick one. You said that the rates for use of the incumbent lines, that's governed by federal regulation. We don't have any control over what those rates are. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the standard, how it's applied is, or excuse me, what the standard is determined at the federal level. The FCC has been in charge of that, but it is actually administered and applied, and specific rates are established at the state level by the Public Utilities Commissions applying that standard to the cases before them.
Thanks. So, if one of your customers has a complaint, where do your complaints go if customers have them? The PUC?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Oxley. I'm general counsel with Echelon, if I may respond to that question. We want our customers to come to us when they have a complaint so we can fix it. We have maintained statistics on that. When customers call us, we answer our phone within 20 seconds with a live person 90% of the time. And they get their problem resolved 90% of the time. Now, if there's an issue that we can't resolve with them, yes, they can go to the Public Utilities Commission, which has a consumer representative. Mm-hmm. They can also go to the Attorney General's office, which has the Residential and Small Business Utilities Division. Both those agencies will attempt to resolve the complaint with the customer and the utility in a kind of mediation framework. If that fails to bring a result, the customer can resort to other forums. Small claims court is one. Another one is a regular fully judicial court, I guess.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to follow up on your last sentence there. Is the Minnesota PUC a real referee, or is it a paper tiger?
Mr. Oxley.
Mr. Chair, Representative, You know, I go over and I appear in front of the Public Utilities Commission from time to time, and they've never seemed like a paper tiger to me. They have a voice that carries the force of law in Minnesota. They have the ability to assess penalties in certain circumstances. They can refer complaints to the Attorney General's office to refer things. However, that's authority that they have vis-a-vis a company, vis-a-vis disputes between companies. The authority has been limited by a recent decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, specifically on the matter of wholesale service quality standards. The Supreme Court said the Public Utilities Commission has the authority to establish wholesale service quality standards, but the Supreme Court judged that the legislature had not given the commission the authority to enforce those standards through penalties and remedial payments. So with regard to intra-industry concerns, I still wouldn't call them a paper tiger, but they certainly don't have much in their arsenal. With regard to disputes between companies and customers, you've given them a lot of authority, including the ability to yank a company's certificate of authority to serve. They could put you out of business if they decided to. But in that wholesale realm, they don't have it, and that's one of the things that we think is an essential cornerstone for a competitive marketplace. The referee who can say, this is what customers in Minnesota ultimately need, is companies who can provide them with high levels of service. And when companies depend upon each other to provide service, the commission needs to be able to referee that.
Follow up? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. With that, that's the end of our testifiers. Members, I know it's about noon. We're going to be locking up this room, so you can leave your stuff. We'll be back at 1:30. Is there any quick comments on a working group strategy? What I would like to do is maybe Representative Thiessen, you can talk to some of your comments on a working group strategy. What I would like to do is maybe Representative Thiessen, you can talk to some of your members and have your staff talk to Brian Fahey and our the Republican members. Talk to Brian as well if you have an interest in that, and furthermore, if anybody would have an interest in serving on a working group, let Brian know as well, and feel free to copy me on the email, and Brian and I will be in touch, and we can see where we go from here. With that, meeting is recessed till 1:30.